Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
So, welcome to New Books in Critical Theory, which is a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Matthew Thompson about his new book, Reconstructing Public Housing, Liverpool's Hidden History of Collective Alternatives. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be here.
I enjoyed this book immensely, partially because it's about Liverpool, which, you know, almost immediately kind of puts it into my good books, but also because it engages with what is a kind of major problem for British economy and society, but actually, you know, much more globally, which is the problem of housing and, you know, what we do about both, you know, housing practice and housing policy. And I think we'll unpack the kind of lessons from Liverpool and your approach to things like housing cooperatives, the kind of broad kind of critical framework that you've got. But one thing that's important about the book, and it's important to stress about the book, is it's also a book that's about a place, not just a book about kind of housing policy or housing theory. And it's worth kind of starting, I think, with the place. And this is a funny question to kick off with about, you know, could you introduce Liverpool? But, you know, and how do you introduce a city? It's a tricky question, but it would be good to know maybe about why you chose Liverpool. What are some of the kind of, you know, unique and interesting characteristics that made Liverpool a good place to do housing research?
Interesting question. I mean, this is the kind of question that I open the book with, I guess. Why Liverpool? And it does frame some of the book's themes around exceptionalism and Liverpool exceptionalism when it comes to some of the issues around housing and placemaking. I guess, I mean, Liverpool's a fascinating city, right? I mean, it's as you say, Dave, you know, you're drawn to it yourself and you've lived there yourself. And I've lived there for a couple of years as well, following my PhD, which was about, obviously, Liverpool. And I mean, it's a city that's always been in but not of England, as the sort of saying goes, I guess. And so it's sort of been on the margins and it's been at the intersections of different continents, I suppose, as well as on the margins of the British Isles, sort of related to Ireland and Wales and Scotland as much to England. And, you know, it's a city that's been through a hell of a lot of change over the last 200 years or so, always in many ways at the forefront of some of these big global systemic trends of industrialization, colonialism, deindustrialization, and now trying to find a way through this sort of post-industrial transition. And through those really sort of tumultuous changes where the city, for instance, Liverpool itself lost half its population in less than half a century. So we're talking 800,000 people down to 400,000 people from 1930 to 1980 or so. And in that period, you know, the city's gone through huge cataclysmic change and struggle, class struggle particularly, but also community struggle has been a big part of that. And so you see that manifested in housing and housing experimentation, both from the state, the local state, and various different sort of professional groups and associations, but also from working class communities, particularly around that time in the 1960s and 70s, going through those changes, responded in quite interesting ways, produced, I guess, the British Isles' largest and most innovative housing cooperative movements, or one of, alongside Glasgow and London. But for a city of its size, Liverpool really did sort of punch above its weight in that regard. So we're talking sort of close to 50 co-ops were set up, and many of which continued to operate today. They were set up in the early 1970s, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And so the curious historical process of that movement really drew me to the city originally. I was doing a PhD on kind of looking at alternative ways to do regeneration, not just housing, but regeneration as a kind of wider issue. I'd done a planning master's in London. I kind of had this idea that I was going to go into urban planning, town planning, after my undergraduate. And I ended up doing a PhD because I sort of came into the master's at the time of the global financial crash, and that obviously affected property markets big time, and it obviously affected design planning firms, and so no one was hiring. But fortuitously, I ended up with a PhD in Manchester. I'm very interested in alternative ways of doing regeneration and urban design and placemaking generally, and housing was a big part of that. And Liverpool really, it caught my imagination for a number of reasons. There were some really interesting things going on there in contemporary terms, you know, in the community land trusts that were emerging in the city, Homebaked and Granby, which are a big part of the book. The only other city that really has that kind of sort of creativity and innovation in contemporary collective housing is London. And being based in Manchester, it seemed like a natural place to go to, really. Liverpool, and actually I could jump on the train and go there, you know, to and fro week by week. And the other factor, of course, was my supervisor, Steve Hinks, was born and bred Scouser, and he was like, "Why don't you look at Liverpool? This city is ripe for this stuff." And it was a great bit of advice in many ways.
It always a good bit of advice to look at Liverpool. Always a good bit of advice that. You threw up a couple of points that will be useful to kind of clarify before we get into the kind of core points the book is making. One is this thing about co-ops, about I think you describe them as kind of collective housing alternatives in the book. You mentioned, you know, Glasgow, London having a history of this. One question is like, so what are we talking about? What are these things? But I suppose part of the definition of what a collective housing alternative, what a housing co-op is in response to a kind of bigger question about how we should understand housing, which kind of animates the book. So maybe you could kind of sketch out these collective alternatives, what housing co-ops are, and then we can move on to kind of think about some broader questions about the nature of housing itself.
Yeah, sure. So maybe let's go through a nice, neat definition of collective housing alternatives. So, I mean, they're a kind of collection of alternatives to public and private ways of owning and managing land and housing, particularly affordable housing. So, you know, public forms might include council housing in the UK, other forms of state ownership, and private is the usual, you know, either rented or owner-occupied in various other forms, provided by the market. And so collective housing alternatives are very much an alternative to the public forms of affordable housing, and they're rooted in traditions of commons and cooperativism. So it's about cooperative ways of governing spaces for living, and there are multiple different kind of incarnations of this, I guess. So you've got housing cooperatives, which the book is very broadly about. Community land trusts, as I've mentioned, co-ownership models, co-partnership models, co-housing, which is a big movement in Europe, particularly, and also in the States, and various different other kind of legal organizational forms that can kind of sit within this sort of umbrella term. I mean, I've chosen collective housing alternatives quite explicitly out of a range of different options, I guess. I frame it in that way, when in fact the field in which I'm sort of writing in, community-led housing, uses that term, uses community-led. And on the continent, in continental Europe, there's an emerging term around collaborative housing. And these are more commonly used, I guess, to describe the similar kinds of things. But I take issue really with these two different definitions for various reasons. I mean, first is in community-led housing, there's a kind of parochialism to it. There's an inward-looking focus on the community. And I guess what I'm trying to do with collective housing alternatives is really flag the relationship to the public, to notions of accountability and democratic outwardness as alternatives to public housing, and not just a sort of community-led, you know, defined community sort of solution that can sometimes be a bit isolated from wider discourses and wider issues. And collaborative as well, I take issue with, because it sort of suggests it puts the partnership aspects and the collaboration aspects to the fore, and perhaps underplays which basically means that it allows for commodified versions or sort of privatized versions of collective living. So, for instance, owner-occupied co-housing. What I'm trying to do in the book is describe an alternative way beyond capitalism and beyond commodified forms of ownership. So collective housing alternatives really does it really does underline that decommodified aspect. So this is land and housing that has been taken off the market explicitly in order to avoid the pitfalls that the market opens in terms of and sort of opens for dwellers, really, in terms of the spaces they inhabit.
Could you give me any examples? I mean, I'm sort of struck, one way of reading the book is as a kind of set of examples of the 70s, the 80s, maybe a bit of a lull in the 1990s, and then the kind of the emergence of where we are now with this alternative to both, you know, kind of state, local state, and market approaches to housing. And maybe we can start in the 70s because that's sort of where you see the roots of the present day, really. And again, I mean, it's interesting what you'd sketch there, the idea of, you know, taking land out of market relations, the idea of commons, because in some ways that the initial kind of moments of the co-ops that you're thinking about in Liverpool in the 70s are critical of, you know, both the kind of activities of the council. They're certainly critical of, you know, a kind of failing housing market, but also I guess there's, you know, a setting that allowed them to emerge as this alternative. So yeah, what's the story of the birth of the co-ops in the 70s?
Yeah, very good question. this is obviously something that I try and cover at length in the opening chapters of the book. But I'll do my best to summarise. So, I guess Liverpool at the time in the mid 70s was facing severe issues around housing dereliction and decline and sort of deprivation, I guess, in relation to housing. So I frame this in terms of the housing question. So Frederick Engels' sort of original provocation to those of us on the left, I guess, trying to think beyond capitalism. And the housing question is broadly the question of how to provide dwelling, adequate dwelling for all of us who live in capitalist economies, when capitalism actually reproduces scarcity, deprivation, alienation, and other forms related to the exploitation that capitalism basically sort of thrives upon. And back in the day, back in the 19th century, Engels was his imagined interlocutor was Proudhon. The anarchist, the French anarchist Proudhon, who actually was unfortunately already dead by the time that Engels was writing, was debating with him in his book, The Housing Question. But the debate was around whether small scale alternatives like collective housing alternatives, like co-ops, could ever provide a solution to the housing question, could ever go beyond the capitalist production of housing, which reproduces scarcity within it continually and creates division and inequalities and alienation and so on. And those those anarchists, I guess, that are heirs to Proudhon's philosophy, would argue in a way that they could, in some respect, provide at least some isolated solution or some localized solution. And Engels, in the Marxist tradition, countered in very convincing terms. Really, it's very difficult to argue with Engels. The logic is rigorous. You know, the global system, you know, systematic kind of integration of housing production within capital means that we'll never escape this unless we abolish the mode of capital itself. But I guess here then the question becomes, how do we abolish the mode of capital? And so there are kind of transitional what we call prefigurative forms of moving beyond capital that are expressed in these different forms of collective housing alternatives. So they kind of prefigure a different kind of society within the structures and social practices that they embody and that they express. Now, in the 70s in Liverpool, you had a situation where the debate resounded basically down the decades. You've got Colin Ward, the anarchist planner, which sounds like a bit of a paradox. Colin Ward, the anarchist planner, he was quite a big figure in the town and country planning movement, coming out of the Garden Cities in the 19th century, and also the anarchist architect, the Barefoot architect, John F.C. Turner, and they were the heirs to Proudhon and believed that housing that's controlled and managed and run democratically and collectively, but ultimately autonomously by residents, by those that actually live in the dwellings, that housing will always provide a better source of living. It will heal divisions. It will heal the ultimate division between the user and producer of dwellings, between the kind of between the act of dwelling and the product that it sort of works through and produces. And these ideas had, if over time they become generalized through society, they have a chance of beginning to prefigure this new society. And these ideas are around user autonomy, as Turner would call it, or collective dweller control, as Ward would call it, infused the ideas of various working class communities in Liverpool in mid-1970s. And one of these communities was the Weller Street Co-op. And this was the first, this ended up being the first new build co-op, so a co-op that was built from the ground up, not just a rehabilitation of old terraces, but a new build co-op that was designed, developed, and eventually owned and managed by its resident members. And they were very much influenced by Ward's book, Tenants Take Over, in which he formulated these ideas around dweller control. That's only one half of the story. So the Weller Street were motivated, the Weller Street community were motivated by some of those radical ideas circulating in the 70s around those anarchist ideas around autonomy and dweller control. But they were also motivated by need, by pressing need, quite urgent, really, in terms of their present living conditions. So they were threatened, but on the one hand, by deteriorating material conditions of the housing in which they were living in inner South Liverpool, around Toxteth, which is very close to Granby, which I mentioned earlier, where the CLT is, Community Land Trust is doing work today. And they're very close to the docks. So lots of the community, like many of the co-ops in Liverpool that followed the Weller Street, were employed in the docks. But the dock work at the time was drying up very quickly. So Liverpool, the reason why it lost half its population in less than half a century was because it lost its kind of global economic position within colonial capitalism as a preeminent seaport, and its maritime economy pretty much collapsed during the mid 20th century following World War II, and left a lot of people unemployed and a lot of the neighborhoods in which these people were living, you know, in quite severe need. Less money investing in local services and shops and so on, and it ricocheted outwards. And the houses themselves were built speculatively in the 19th century to house many migrants, often Welsh, often Irish, or actually particularly in Toxteth and Granby, migrants from all parts of the world, really, Caribbean, Southeast Asia, drawn to Liverpool through seafaring. But the Weller Street community were quite a tight-knit Catholic white working class community. These houses were falling down that pretty much by this point in the 70s, and there was not much money around to, as I say, to maintain them. That was one pressure. Houses were unfit for human habitation. They were basically slums. There were no, you know, there's no inside toilets, no baths, no hot running water. The community and others like it really wanted them rebuilt. They were demanding better housing conditions. They were managed by the council. Liverpool Council owned this stock at the time. They were council tenants, or what they called the Corpy Corporation, Liverpool Corporation, as it was known. And the council represented, if you like, both an opportunity and a threat as well, another threat, because what they were trying to do, quite understandably and admirably, in this sort of modernist post-war period, was to rationalise many of these inner city slums through their what they called the Slum Clearance Programme. So it was actually called the Slum Clearance Programme, even as late as the 1970s, for good reason, perhaps. And they were rehousing their tenants in new built, much more hygienic, all the mod cons, kind of beautifully set out, you know, modernist estates, but often on the perimeter, if you like, on the periphery of the metropolitan area, in new boroughs around places like Runcorn, and Skelmersdale, Kirby, or elsewhere within the city region itself, within the city itself. But many of the residents wouldn't actually be rehoused together, so they didn't have enough housing stock to basically ensure that all those able to stay together. So the Wedder Streets were basically campaigning against being broken up as a community. They wanted new housing, but they wanted to stay together. And so the idea of a co-op presented itself. And this was partly because at the time the national legislation was being enacted in the 1974 Housing Act that enabled, that basically sort of brought co-ops to the fore of the public housing debate. Housing associations were being mooted as a kind of alternative to council housing at the time, and housing co-ops were quite fortuitously sort of included within this policy regime that generously funded the development of new housing association and cooperative housing, and many different professional organisations specialising in the development of cooperative housing and housing association housing as a kind of third sector to the public and private sectors. They set up shop in Liverpool to take advantage of this, in many ways, to take advantage of this new regime, this new policy regime. And one of these groups called CDS, Cooperative Development Services, big player in this story, they worked very closely with the Wedder Street Co-op to basically pioneer this new model of co-op development, where they would work in this really intensive mutual learning process of participatory design, democratic design. They would train up the residents in different skills in planning and all sorts of, you know, surveying all sorts of different aspects from the development process from start to finish. So they would upskill the residents to interview architects, for instance, and contractors, and then those architects and contractors would work likewise with the residents, but only as their kind of as their servants. So it flipped on the head this kind of professional client relationship. These communities had never really experienced that before. And they built what the communities demanded, really, of them. So they were the scribes rather than the actual kind of, the architects were just the scribes, and the communities themselves told them what to draw, as one of the phrases of the Wedder Streets had it. And that process of it was an incredible process of empowerment. So the communities themselves were kind of united, if you like, around this new form of solidarity. The process of campaigning brought them together and inspired this kind of long-term practices of cooperation, which kept the co-op going after the process of building it was complete. But also individual members, you know, through that all those processes of unemployment and deprivation that was rife in Liverpool at the time, many people found new jobs and found new skills through this process, and others were politicized and radicalized to become councillors, local councillors within, often representing their communities in the Labour Party, sometimes in the Communist Party. And some of them actually went on to become cabinet members within the local council and reformed some of the council policy around housing, and actually ended up pushing forward policies that would help the next generation of co-ops. So there was quite an interesting, there's a very interesting sort of virtuous circle that was kick-started by the Wedder Street, and then the other co-ops were followed through this kind of integrated system, if you like, this kind of what many people at the time, many commentators were calling public sector housing 2.0, so a kind of new paradigm in public housing that was basically meant to replace the sort of the top-down, paternalistic, anti-democratic form of public housing of the council, of the Corpi, with this much more participatory, intensive democratic design process, and also then very cooperative governance process that followed, and a mutual form of ownership where each member had, you know, had a stake in each resident had a stake in the actual co-op and the building that they lived in.
I mean, not to give too many spoilers away for potential readers, but yeah, that isn't what happened in terms of the kind of story of housing in the city from the 70s onwards. And what one way of kind of thinking about maybe the kind of contrast between that moment and that desire for a new, you know, mode of housing policy, particularly in terms of who was in control of it and forms of participation, is by jumping all the way forward to today. I mean, the book has got these really rich and very detailed discussions about the 1980s. Some listeners might be familiar with the 1980s as a particularly kind of productive, but also a complicated and conflictual, if that's a word, decade for the city. And there are really interesting case studies in and questions of, you know, well, who has power, who has control, what actually is top down, what is bottom up in terms of some of the case studies from the 80s. But I'd like to kind of get you to talk through some of the more recent case studies to reflect on the promise of the co-op movement and where we are now. So could you tell me the story both of Granby, which is in Liverpool 8, which you know, you've talked about the whether we'd call it the kind of, this is a multicultural district in the city. It, you know, it's quite close to the city centre, but has its own unique housing challenges. And you'd mentioned some of the questions of kind of poor quality housing. And then there's, you know, a narrative of the reemergence and regeneration of the area following the 1980s. And then there's also a story about community land trusts in there, stories of, you know, artists, pie shops, kind of local transformations in the north of the city as well. So yeah, what's the story of the community land trust in Granby and in Anfield, and what do they tell us about the similarities and differences with the co-ops of the 70s?
Okay, great. So I mean, if you don't mind, I'm going to do the same as what I just did, which is to frame that question in the abstract terms of the theory in which I introduce it in the book. Hopefully not too much of a long-winded answer, but so in this, as you say, Dave, you know, the 1980s were quite a kind of conflictual sort of time, quite contradictory in many ways. And what I suggest in the book is that, so the book is framed in three parts, which broadly correlate to the three different decades or long decades. The first part of is the housing question, as I've introduced it. And sort of, I've obviously brushed over and given a quite an idealistic reading of that. But by the 1980s, the problem, if you like, had changed from the focus on deprivation at a housing level to a focus on deprivation at a neighbourhood level. So I call this the neighbourhood question. And this is not far from Engels' original question. I mean, he moves in that direction and starts talking about uneven urban development, how because of the nature of global capital roving around the world, looking for opportunities to valorize itself, you end up with this kind of seesaw, this locational seesaw, as capital flees and then refixes at different places. And Liverpool, being the city that it was at the time, obviously went through this kind of tumultuous evacuation of capital, and whole neighborhoods where it became kind of host to these symptomatic problems of abandoned neighborhood abandonment and you know, empty properties, hundreds of empty properties, and what policymakers by the 1990s were calling an oversupply of Victorian terraces. There just literally weren't enough people to fill them, and the market was crashing as a result. And in that period, the kind of the solution, if you like, the kind of localized, isolated solution, changed as well from co-ops to community development trusts, which had their own particular structure and different ways of solving those issues, which I won't talk about now. But by the 1990s and 2000s, I move into new theoretical terrains and talk about the urban question. The neighborhood question now scales up into the urban question. And this is kind of, I guess, where so Marxist scholars following Engels, I guess, working in his shadow in many ways, and obviously going way beyond him, though people like Castells and Lefebvre and Harvey and Merrifield, I pick up on these theorists and think and try to work through the idea that the urban space itself, the urban land and space and the buildings that are on it, become sites of capital accumulation and ways in which capital can valorize itself, huge drivers and engines of profit making in ways which they just weren't before by the 2000s. And so in Liverpool, we see that manifested. So you get this kind of this crazy concatenation of different forces in Liverpool where there's empty houses and those abandoned neighborhoods become sites of forms of profit making driven by the state, by the local state, in consort with the national state, also in partnership with private developers and housing associations, in what I call grant regimes. And quite interestingly, these housing associations were actually, some of them had morphed out of the original cooperative development agencies that had started the co-op movement in the 70s. So CDS became Plusdane. Plusdane was now embroiled in these new partnerships for basically regenerating these terraced streets in a program called Housing Market Renewal. Housing Market Renewal was a massive program that was set up by the New Labour government in the early 2000s across many northern cities in England, multi-billion pounds, quite similar to Hope 6, I think it is in the US. So this is about replacing, demolishing, and rebuilding, comprehensively clearing, sometimes rehabilitating vast swathes of under-occupied or difficult-to-let houses, or those in England, as it was framed, suffering from market failure, housing market failure. So this is where housing and neighbourhoods become kind of objectified as commodities and as markets. They're space. They're just purely markets, not spaces to live in, and they're failed as markets rather than failed as spaces to actually sort of inhabit and live a life. So this was the next round of comprehensive clearance, if you like, following the slum clearances of the 70s. And Housing Market Renewal swept through inner areas like Granby and Anfield, where the community land trusts eventually emerged in response to it. So here we see community land trusts becoming the vehicle for the solution, if you like, to the urban question as it's been reframed from the housing questions. Rather than co-ops, we have CLTs. And the CLTs are the legal articulation that's sort of inscribed in their organization is set up such that they can actually provide some alternative to this form of development, this form of profit making development. I mean, if I quickly touch on how the council and the housing associations and the private developers made money out of this. They first got huge subsidies from the government to demolish housing. They compulsorily purchased up properties at a low price and then consolidated those properties into land banks, sold them on to private developers and to rebuild. Make money through the sale of new houses, but also the council then also profits from higher rate council taxes as a result. And housing associations are also involved in that because it's a quite complex argument, but basically they raise the asset value of houses that they own because the whole area is improved as a result, and they're able to borrow more money on private markets, which is the way that they actually manage to fund affordable housing development. Quite a complicated set of factors all emanating out of reforms from the 1980s, neoliberal reforms of the 1980s around housing. But in response to this, residents in these areas that were mooted for development campaigned vociferously against demolition and displacement and being broken up as a community in kind of similar ways to what you see, what we saw in the Weller Street and other co-ops in the 1970s. But in this situation, so in Granby in particular, the context was quite different. So this is, as you say, Dave, it was a multicultural area of Liverpool, still is very much so. It's the centre of the oldest, most established black community in the UK, not far away from what was the largest and oldest Chinatown in Europe. It's always been the centre of diaspora from various different parts of the world. Obviously, Liverpool has an incredible seafaring heritage, and various different people have ended up settling from all over the world in this space. So, you know, for instance, it's got the Liverpool Malay Club. So Singaporean and Malaysian sailors would often come to socialise in a club on in and around Granby. So Granby itself, this small neighbourhood, was the centre of the very rich kind of multicultural culture. But it suffered decline like the rest of Liverpool, and was mooted for demolition. The housing stock was beautiful; it still is. It's been saved. So you can see how there was a kind of vested interest in this from the word go. I mean, the kind of housing that was there would be incredibly valuable in another kind of context, like London, for instance. But in Liverpool, it was worth very little at the time because of market failure. But residents still lived there, some of them laid down in front of bulldozers. They painted Antal Vandal paint on doors that workmen were trying to get into to basically rip apart the houses within, the kind of sort of signifier of the civic vandalism that was going on. And through this sort of this process, this particular community in Granby, they started to sort of experiment with an alternative. It started around sort of guerrilla gardening, the kind of insurgent forms of temporary urbanism, if you like, that and gardening and kind of plant growing. In the street, these derelict streets that hadn't really been occupied very much for the last several decades, and the council had stopped collecting bins, and they'd stopped, the streetlights had been turned off, so there was a kind of managed decline going on. In that context, the homeowners that remained that hadn't been kicked out because they owned their properties, unlike some of the tenants, started this process of beautifying the area and kind of creating this kind of green oasis in amongst the dereliction. And that attracted more and more people to get involved in the project. There's a street market that was set up that sort of enabled people on low incomes, particularly in that area, to have, you know, access to different forms of trading and social reproduction in these difficult economic circumstances. And that became very popular as well. And it formed the basis for a campaign around a community land trust. So where the vision through this community land trust was for the neighbourhood to be retained rather than demolished, and it would be owned by the community for the longer term redevelopment of the wider area. And the way that the CLT worked compared to a co-op is that it has a different kind of legal framework, if you like. So it's based on a trust structure rather than a cooperative ownership structure. The trust structure, if you like, sits kind of above the ownership of the buildings. It sort of owns the land through a kind of almost sort of stewardship or trusteeship type value system, where different aspects of the community, different parts of the community, are represented on a democratically elected board, and that board sort of is accountable for the direction of this organization and of the stewardship of that wider area. And then the buildings themselves, which the trust owns, can be leased to individuals or to organisations and collectives. So in the case of Granby, you have a situation where a cooperative, a fully mutualised housing cooperative, is leasing five buildings from the CLT. So it works in combination with co-ops. You start to see some interesting kind of hybrid or sort of partnership workings between different collective housing alternatives. And because of that stewardship role, the CLT, and the way that the governance structure is about this kind of wider stakeholder kind of participation rather than just cooperative members only, as in the case of co-ops. So it sort of looks to the wider community. It means that it does include or has the potential to include much more of a diverse sort of local community and local stakeholders who may feel that they have some stake in that space. And so it enables this kind of almost democratic deliberation. It's a kind of arena or an umbrella for thinking through and debating the future of a space, unlike perhaps a co-op, which is much more inward looking and is much more about member benefit alone. So there's some really interesting interesting progressions and contrasts with the 1970s in ways which perhaps reflect that kind of more diverse space of Granby, but also reflects the nature of the contemporary nature of the urban question.
as you were talking, I was really struck by, not to sound like the kind of local tourist board, but it's worth going actually round this area of Liverpool to see actually precisely, you know, the reemergence of, as you mentioned, the street market, the idea of, you know, the kind of, in some parts of it, the kind of re-greening of the space. And you could say sort of, you know, in some ways what's happened in the north of the city is, you know, kind of complicated by the presence of things like the football club and kind of inward, maybe sort of tourism or almost. But yeah, the Granby example, as you'd sketched out, particularly this question of kind of control and engagement is, I suppose, you know, the evolution and also a method of kind of solving some of the problems that the book details around co-ops. And yeah, you know, listeners should go there and you know, should kind of see what this project, this mode of collective alternatives has done for the area. I suppose, though, and you know, you kind of flagged some US examples as you were talking, but the big question that comes from the book, and we've, you know, only sort of scratched the surface with the book, is the extent to which you think there are, you know, lessons for other places, you know, the extent to which, for quite good reasons, some of the things that have gone on in Liverpool have really unique local dynamics that have driven them, whether it's tensions with the city council over a kind of 30-year period, irrespective of the political makeup of that organization, or whether it's, you know, particular kind of place-based narratives. And again, you know, you flagged up the quality of housing stock in the Granby area that, you know, in other cities in the UK would be, you know, hugely kind of desirable and probably extremely expensive. So yeah, to what extent is the kind of the Liverpool story a lesson for other places? Are things like community land trusts, you know, the sorts of things that could be recommended for other places, or is the story of reconstructing public housing really a Liverpool story only?
Good question. Fresh question. Sorry, I forgot that I didn't really mention Homebaked after you'd introduced the pies. I can touch on Homebaked. The Homebaked is sort of Liverpool's, is Granby's sister, if you like, on the other side of Liverpool, next to Liverpool Football Club. I can maybe touch on some of that in this response.
I mean, basically, like, can everywhere have a really high quality pie shop as part of their housing policy?
So this is kind of interesting. So Homebaked is an interesting example of some of the sort of spatial dynamics and the kind of the exceptionalism argument, I guess, which is really like on a knife edge with this book. And I don't really think I satisfactorily answer it. I sort of just open questions really around whether there is, how do we replicate these things? How do we scale them up? Can they be reproduced in other places in different contexts where there aren't perhaps all these different factors? So I use a lot of metaphors inspired by Homebaked, pies particularly. So Homebaked is a bakery co-op in Anfield, opposite the football club. And I'm sort of using a lot of they use sort of they have reports and different sort of blog entries and things and that play on the fact that they produce bread and pies, and they talk about a recipe for revolution, for instance. And so in this recipe for revolution, I'm trying to basically in the book I'm sort of riffing off of this and trying to think about what are the ingredients for these things to basically like emerge and flourish elsewhere, not just in Liverpool. I think I identify like, I don't know, 7 factors, and some of them are very, very specific, you know, like the opportunity presented by the availability of land, low cost land, that both in the 70s and today, the co-ops and CLTs have actually capitalized upon. Very, very difficult to do this perhaps in London, although there are CLTs in London emerging, but just on the flip side of the coin of capitalism, I guess, or capitalist land markets. You know, there's the kind of histories in Liverpool of radical kind of organizing, linked to kind of an anarcho-syndicalist kind of seafaring culture, which has quite specific, and it's a city of radicals. It's often portrayed. It's got this kind of you know, it's got a swagger. It's got a kind of firebrand, anti-authoritarian finger up to kind of you know, England and capitalist bosses' approach to life, and it's a wonderful space to really to be in that respect. But that doesn't translate necessarily across other places. So, you know, how do we get beyond these sort of factors that are quite specific? Johnson Birchall, co-op theorist whose work, The Hidden History of Housing in the UK, is kind of what I'm also drawing on in a way. I'm doing a hidden history of Liverpool's co-ops. He uses ecological cultivation metaphors around the environment, the climate, the cultivators. What kind of factors do you need for these things? A sort of horticultural kind of a metaphor for the factors that you need to make these things flourish. It needs to be rained upon by finance, you know, that we saw in the 70s, but do we see it today in the CLTs? In many ways, yeah. So, I mean, by doing that, by kind of delineating those ingredients, I'm trying to sort of systematize and set out what it might take to actually establish an infrastructure for building them elsewhere. And I guess I kind of boil it down to sort of three different approaches, I suppose. So building an infrastructure within the movements of community, of not just community land trust, but collective housing alternatives more broadly is really important. So how do we federate? How do we kind of network these things into a structure that can actually withstand attacks from hostile forces, perhaps Thatcher's government in the 80s, or we haven't talked about militant council, but that was a big factor in the mid 80s in Liverpool. But also then how to sort of like reproduce some of the values over time and stop co-ops or CLTs to degenerate as generations move and perhaps the kind of early lessons of solidarity and the kind of excitement of a campaign struggle start to dissipate. What to do after that? So the book touches on a lot of those issues. So building an infrastructure from below, building a kind of structure, a bureaucracy, if you like, for sort of facilitating the expansion of these things through democratic processes is a real key part of the conclusion of this book. And there's a real tension in that, you know, so bureaucracy entails a kind of ossification, a calcification of these kind of organic energies, these creative energies that really push forward and drive these kind of radical kind of political initiatives from below, from the people themselves. Over time, you need ways to actually to make them happen, perhaps more systematically or in other places that don't have those radical energies, maybe. Then you need procedures, but procedures by nature actually, you know, end up bureaucratizing things and making them boring. So I kind of, you know, I try to sort of I sort of really dig into that dialectic of kind of organic energy and sort of bureaucratic structure. So in Liverpool, you have a situation now where Breaking Ground has been established this year, just gone, which is a kind of community-led housing hub at the city regional level for facilitating the development of all different kinds of collective housing alternatives, so co-ops, co-housing, CLTs. This is coming together of the movement into a kind of much more infrastructural kind of formation, which is brilliant news. You had the Merseyside Federation of Housing Co-ops in the 70s and 80s. That disbanded in the 90s. So this is the Breaking Ground is a real is a really interesting development. Another aspect that I touch on is the state. How do we get the state to support this stuff? So there's a real tension between the tradition of the commons or community-led housing, which is done, you know, autonomously, independently through self-organization, very much, and the commons as a kind of anti-capitalist discourse is very much antagonistic toward the state as a social form of capital. But nonetheless, I try to kind of tease apart those contradictions and say, well, hang on, the state is a powerful institutional infrastructure that we need, if you like, in the movement to at least enable some of the legal codes, for instance, or legislative apparatus, and also funding regimes. If we don't have an infrastructure purely in the movement itself, so if, you know, for instance, legal reforms have happened in the last decade. The 2014 Cooperative Act recently that's established new kinds of cooperative community benefit societies, which is what community land trusts are becoming recently, which they have different kind of benefits and advantages legally that opens up different forms of finding funding or different ways of working, which can help. So a big part of the book at the end is, how do we re-engineer the state to do this? What do we need? You know, do we need insurgent kind of guerrilla kind of bureaucrats going in, like we perhaps might have seen with the Corbyn-McDonnell leadership of the Labour Party before it failed cataclysmically, perhaps in late 2019? Or at a local level, you see, for instance, the Preston model, which is using a community wealth building strategy that's been imported from the US, from the Cleveland model, through the likes of the Democracy Collaborative, now basically trying to re-engineer the local state to basically sort of favor the development of things like this. So they're using procurement flows of key anchor institutions, so hospitals, universities, the local council, police constabularies, county councils, you name it, public, non-profit, anchored organizations that really can't move, like Footloose Capital or corporate businesses. How do we tap into those flows, the spending capacities that those organizations have, to actually start to divert some of that money into, say, worker-owned co-ops or community land trusts, to set up different kinds of ways of owning, managing the economy, which includes housing, of course. So there are these different factors. And then the last I guess, sort of approach that I sort of suggest and start to tease apart in the book is kind of building a narrative, thinking about how we communicate this stuff and translate this stuff between different mediums. And I suppose in quite humble terms, this book is one of my attempts at doing that, trying to communicate. I try to write it in not too academic terms, with as little academies as I could possibly bear to write, in a way which I hope communicates the value of these things. But, you know, we need to sort of, the last part of the book is about myth making and about how the right has a lot of myths that are set up to basically, myths and legends and parables and stories that are set up to basically, undermine and discredit commons and community-led alternatives and collective housing alternatives. So, for instance, like, you know, Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons parable is the thing that resounds in people's minds when they think about the commons. But how do we reconfigure this stuff? How do we re-narrate it and tell different stories that can communicate this stuff down the generations, but also expand it out quickly so the public is interested in this stuff and the imaginations are caught by these things, which is a difficult task when we're dominated by ideologies around home ownership, but also around general kind of atomized individualism and commodity trading and under neoliberal capitalism. So I guess that sort of broadens the story back out. I don't know if I've got enough time, but I could possibly comment on home-based situation, which I haven't done yet.
Well, I think the question to wrap up with is those maybe like, kind of three lessons. Is that something you're going to be kind of working on next? Is there a kind of book actually spinning out the kind of how you overturn some of the myths that percolate around housing? Or are you thinking about doing kind of a completely different set of research work now?
Well, I'm currently working on a project around municipalism. So municipalism and community wealth building and cooperative alternatives in cities. So I'm trying to scale up this question from housing alternatives at a neighbourhood level, if you like, to thinking about cities more broadly. And so that's why the Preston model comes into this book, I suppose, in that it frames the next. And I'm thinking about this in terms of political economy and the flows of value as they move through cities. And so I guess here we go. This is my chance to actually sort of set up this homemade. Finally, actually, talk about this homemade example. So the homemade co-op that makes pies and bread is opposite the Liverpool Football Club. Now, that is its source of income because it gets huge amounts of money from the football fans that flood past it, if you like, on their way to and from the stadium on match days. So it's reliant, it's kind of anchor, it's in a way, it's an anchor, it's a community anchor organization that does a lot of amazing stuff for the local community. But its source of value is tied very much into this global capitalist football club circuit, right? We've recently seen with the European Super League, for instance. And so there's a kind of interesting contradiction there around the political economic sources and barriers to these things. So they're often tied in to the global economy in ways which are not simply this or that, black or white. Very complicated. So, for instance, Liverpool Football Club was another one of the threats that motivated the CLT to then take on this terrace that the home-baked bakery sits on. It was trying to expand its stadium and demolish many of the terrace houses, and it worked in concert with Housing Market Renewal at the time. So it's both the Liverpool Football Club, like any big, and it's an anchor institution in many ways as well. It's a privately owned one. It's both friend and foe of the movement and in a way represents that kind of flow of capital through a space. How do we harness that flow of capital while at the same time using it in a way extracting value from that flow of capital that in itself has extracted value from elsewhere, to actually then divert into much more socially useful, socially valuable endeavours like the community land trust and the bakery. So the bakery sits in a building, is operating from a building that is owned by the Home Baked Community Land Trust, which is its landlord. And this is a kind of family of businesses that's emerging around here opposite Liverpool Football Club. And so, yeah, I guess I'm really interested in working out how do we think about those kind of relationships at a broader scale of the city, and how cities then actually perhaps cooperate, interact, and actually start to build movements across borders, transnationally. I'm particularly interested in this transatlantic movement emerging between Cleveland and Preston, between the Democracy Collaborative and the Centre for Local Economic Strategies, for instance, in the UK, between the States and the UK. And so I think the questions remain quite similar. I've always been interested in these kind of institutional dynamics of how do we move beyond capital whilst sort of working within it, I suppose, in this contradictory way. And I'm just now, so I don't know when the next book's going to be written, but I'm looking forward to it. And that's, yeah, so comes to the end of a 3-year project, and I'm about to put my...